Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have an episode that I've been personally really looking forward to, and it's with Leanne Tran. How are you, Leanne?
I'm really well. How are you?
I am really well. The reason that I am so well is because Leanne sent me an email and she had an really interesting topic that she wanted to talk about, and it caught my eye. And that topic is why bad behavior is rarely bad at all and how to respond instead. And I thought, is that one of the most interesting topics that I have had sent to me in an email? It is. Before we kick off, because I'm very excited, Leanne, would you mind giving a brief background about who you are?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a psychologist and I've been working with children and families who are developing differently for about 20 years or so in a private practice in Brisbane, but more recently offering support online for parents because this private practice is just really difficult for parents to access lately and to afford. What's brought me into wanting to work with kids who are now neurodivergent is that my husband has ADHD and one of my sons does. And so I've had this moment, like I had in the beginning of my career, where I felt like I was giving good advice to parents and then I had my own kids and went, oh, hang on a second. And now it's the same with kids not developing typically as well. It's just a different situation. And I've done a lot of learning myself that then I've been able to apply in my parenting and really want to share with parents all of the strategies that are different so that they don't feel like they're failing because the typical parenting strategies don't work and they're just not the right ones suited to their child. So that's what I focus a lot of my effort and time on lately.
Oh, I love that. And I just don't think there's enough people in that space, to be honest. It's actually difficult to find people who will work with people individually in some of those tricky areas, because what we're going to talk about today is a tricky area. We are going to kick off because I just want to know all the answers, to be honest. Okay.
Don't we all?
Okay. Leanne, what I wanted to start off with was when we talk about bad behavior and we say it's rarely bad at all, what do we mean in terms of a nervous system or unmet needs, stress responses? Like, how is a neurodivergent child different to a neurotypical child?
If I think about ADHD in particular, the difference is in the regulation system. And so it's not just regulating attention. When we talk about regulating, I guess that's a psychology type word for controlling or managing or moderating. And so an example is that it's not necessarily that ADHD kids aren't paying attention. It's just that they find it harder to focus on what to pay attention to, where to focus their attention and where to block out other things. And that's what we mean about regulating. And the difficulty is not just with regulating attention, it's also with emotions, it's with behavior, and that's where that hyperactivity comes in. It can often be with sleep as well, regulating the sleep systems. So it really means that a child has difficulty in all of these areas that's biologically wired in terms of the regulation. I think with ADHD, there's a lot more similarities within that group, whereas in autism, autistic kids have really different experiences and child to child, there's a lot more difference than similarity.
That's a great point. Although, and I suppose ADHD is that common thread that holds a lot of neurodivergent people together as a theme.
That's right. Yes.
Because of the crossover too. So I think that's a great point because when we talk about ADHD kids, I don't think I've met anybody who is autistic that doesn't have ADHD quite yet. I know there's obviously some, but they're a bit more the minority that they're just straight ADHDers in my experience anyway.
That's interesting to think about. And I guess I probably see the same in my practice as well. And oftentimes if I'm doing assessments about autism, children already have a diagnosis of ADHD a lot of the time. And perhaps then I go on to work with those kind of kids a bit more than the kids who have purely ADHD. So that's my experience as well.
No, I think it's great to clarify that because if we talk broadly about neurodivergence, but really we mean specifically ADHD, we should name that as the particular thing that we're talking about. really appreciate that, because there is some podcasts and books and influencers out there that talk generally around being neurodivergent, but list very different, like you don't know what's what. And I think that really does contribute a little bit to that misinformation where people hear a PTSD trait and think it's an ADHD trait, and that can be really tricky. So I think that's a really good, important point to clarify. What I would really love to touch on is those really conventional behavior strategies. I think ADHD mums particularly would be in the group of people that would be financially holding up some of those sticker systems, the charts, the amount of money that we would have spent on what we think will solve the problem would be huge. However, I also notice that they often don't work. Just wondering, why don't they work, and does it cause a deeper harm? It doesn't work and the child receives that kind of messaging.
That's a really good question, and probably a complex one too. My first thought is about the harm side of things. I don't think it necessarily causes harm, but it might if we're expecting our child to be able to do things that's beyond their capacity. And if we're trying to consistently expecting more of them than they can give, that probably does. You know, I'm always hesitant to tell parents that they're harming their kids, because that's never a nice thing to hear. But I think it sends the message to kids that they're just not good enough and can't do enough. And that over time can be a difficult thing to undo. The typical strategies, sometimes like sticker charts, are still something that I sometimes might recommend for parents of ADHDers, and it depends on their capacity. But I guess the difference is too that firstly, we've got to make sure that what we're asking them to do is within their ability to do. And executive functioning is a big part of being able to complete a task. And for ADHDers, that's generally an area of difficulty. And so what it might mean is that asking your kids to do something over and over again, and it never quite works. Whereas for typical kids, it might work because they'll learn what they're expected to do, and then they have the skills to be able to carry it out. So firstly, I think we've got to make sure that we're asking kids to do what they have the capacity for. Then reinforcement, which is what all those behavior charts are designed to do, can be a good approach, because kids with ADHD do tend to respond to reward a lot better than they do to punishment. So punishment is always not a good route to take, I think. But the key is in being able to reward our kids or reinforce stuff that they have the capacity to do, and that will build and grow over time.
It's so interesting, the whole behavior chart, reward and punishment. It's such a developing space. If we are avoiding punishment, which is a parenting strategy that a lot of us have grown up with, then how would we best get our child to do some of the things that they actually need to do, get ready for school or get in the car? Or if we can reward, but we shouldn't punish, sometimes I feel like I've got a skills gap. Like, what else do I do?
Yeah, absolutely. This is really where we get into the weeds of it, isn't it? What do we actually do in the moment? And I think that, first of all, it starts with the relationship. And I think you've got to have a really strong relationship with your kids. The relationship is what makes kids want to do what we want them to do. You're then operating on the same team. What you think and don't feel that close to you, then you're kind of from opposing teams, and you're going to have a struggle right from the beginning. But I think there's two answers to your question. One is to think about how the best ways to, I guess I use positive behavior support a lot. And the approach I think about a lot from that space is that the best behavior support happens when the behavior is not happening. And so that means teaching our kids all of the skills that they need to be able to do what we're asking of them in the moment. So it's shifting our focus from what we do in the moment as being the most important thing to thinking about that being just the 10% of what we do. And the other 90% of the time, what we do is the best thing for changing behavior. And so an example might be that if, you know, often it's talking about getting out the door in the morning for families. And so it might mean then it's being able to give your child enough support so that they know the stuff they've got to pack in their bag, and they know what's on, they've got their uniform ready. So it's giving them lots of the support, but then maybe also teaching skills about managing time and all of that kind of stuff. So lots of the times you're doing stuff that's teaching and setting up the systems that work when the behavior's not happening, so that in the moment things run a little bit smoother.
Something that struck me when you were talking was that a lot of us ADHDers, my hubby and I together, we have trouble with these things because we don't really have a great grasp ourselves. I've noticed when I tried the rewards chart, I really wanted to blame my children that it was their fault. I really wanted to. But if I was honest, I actually really didn't implement it myself with them. Like, I showed them once and then I was like, why isn't everyone ready? I showed you that chart yesterday. I mean, I don't know why you didn't go back over. Offer me $1 million and get me to do it the second day. I think I'd still struggle.
Yeah.
And for me, I find that very difficult to do. And with fluctuating capacity and hyperactivity myself, I don't do the same things every day in the same order. Attempting to bring them in to get them to do that felt really weird because I didn't actually know how to do that myself.
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you?
That absolutely makes sense to me. And I think I've seen that in my family as well, my home. I guess as a neurotypical person with ADHD in my family gives me a different perspective. So I can see my husband struggle with that sometimes. And I don't have that struggle myself, which is probably what makes it easier. But yeah, it's definitely true. I say to parents a lot too, if the system you've got to try and encourage the behavior, if it's too complex or hard for you, it's definitely too complex and hard for your kids. But the other things are true as well, that if you can't remember it, they can't remember it. If you find it boring as well, they're probably going to find it boring. Things that might be barriers to you implementing it can also let you know what the barriers are for your kids as well. That's why I think it's one piece of the puzzle, but what can come down to it too is trying to have that good relationship and teaching your kids the skills that they need so that generally everyone's feeling calm and happy and more likely to be able to do stuff well. But acknowledging too that this is, you know, we're talking about kids developing and this happens over time. I think if you can take a future approach of thinking that you're just aiming to try and get your kids there one day, then that's enough. They're going to be learning those skills over time and it might be messy and imperfect in the meantime, but they'll get there eventually.
Yeah, you've made some really good points. One thing that was really striking me when you were talking was when a lot of us have got ADHD ourselves, it can feel like as a parent that your child's behavior is a reflection of you. And you can start to really internalize, like, I'm a bad mum because my child is badly behaved. And I'm air quoting badly behaved because that it's just hard to know the right words. But there's that judgment around from other mums that I think actually has reduced, to be fair. I think actually people are a lot more understanding than what they were 10 years ago. That's my personal belief. But I think that's still very much out there that I don't necessarily need another mum to say or look at me in a way. I just feel that myself when my child is hitting, running repeatedly, not coming back when I'm asking, throwing things at me at pickup, whatever it is. I just feel like, wow, that's so embarrassing. I'm humiliated. That's a reflection of me. What kind of message, if that's the way that listeners are feeling, what kind of messaging would you have around that?
First of all, it's really common and parents are always worried about the judgment of others. Well, not always worried about it. I feel like parents always experience that judgment of others at some point in their parenting kids who are neurodivergent. And it can come from other parents. It can also come from our own parents or sometimes even those messages we got as kids as well. So particularly if you used to do the same kind of things as your kids do now, you get that automatic message in your mind from what your mum used to say to you. I wanted to talk about that actually as a part of how to handle what to do when the behavior does happen. But first of all, my message would be to try to set it all aside. It's really difficult to do, but to trust your own intuition about what your children need and that you are the ones that know them the best. You are their best advocate. Nobody probably cares more about how your kids turn out than you do. So to try and just tap into your own intuition and guidance about doing the path that you think is the best one forward, it's really hard to do.
Yeah, it is hard. So what about in terms of, let's say we do have a child kicking off, I like to say. That could be anything. My kids are different every day because sometimes I'm like, oh my God, what are we doing now? We just finished doing that and now we're doing this. What are some things that we could do as mums that would probably work? Something practical that mums could really implement as a bit of a quick win, or something that could go away from this episode and be like, I've got one thing I can try at least. I'll just give it a go.
Yeah, sure. I think the two things are probably tied together. And I think sometimes it's about when our kids are kicking off, that's a good word. It's about trying to not buy into those automatic thoughts about that labels what they're doing, like they're being annoying or badly behaved or difficult, because those are the things that tell us that we are a bad parent and that kind of thing. And trying to do something that will just break that automatic stress response, because often that's what happens. I know I feel it myself when my child's done something and then automatically in the pit of my stomach, this kind of stress happens and I worry about how other people are looking at me and that kind of thing. And so doing something that can break that stress response, trying to take a deep breath or something like that is what I do. But then probably the best thing I can think is that there are these strategies that tend to work well at interrupting that kind of kickoff behavior, are things that are novel, your child doesn't expect, and they are ones that can tend to interrupt the behavior really quickly. And that comes from positive behavior support in theory. It might be doing something that they're not expecting you to do. For example, at home, I've done this before where I'll just start singing at the top of my voice and the kids all stop and they look around and they're like, what the hell is going on? It's harder to do in public, but something that they're not expecting that really breaks the behavior. And then it gives you that extra space to be able to deal with it later on. Yeah. So I'm trying to think what you could actually do in the pickup line if they're doing something like, hey, you want ice cream, or something random and left field and positive that will break that behavior cycle.
Do you think there's different levels of kicking off? Sometimes I feel like if we talk about like they're fighting, squabbling, like I want to go to the petrol station and I want to get a dream chocolate, like it's a bit of a rev up. And if I'm, let's say, talking to another mum, I ignore it because I just want to talk to somebody and I just ignore it because I can't be bothered in that moment. And then let's say you leave it a few minutes and the next thing you know, they're going up and they're going up. What you do change in the level of escalation, does it not change? It's the same. That would work across.
That strategy would work across all the levels, but it's definitely one that's designed towards 10 out of 10 kicking off. We talked about what this episode's all about is how it's rarely bad at all. Behavior is a way that kids communicate to us what they need. And so that example you gave about talking to another parent and your child's kind of doing something, that's a way of communicating. And generally, most of us, if we get ignored or someone doesn't respond to us, we tend to talk louder. And I see behavior following that same pattern. If kids are behaving because they're trying to communicate something and we don't respond, their behavior gets louder. So maybe escalates a little bit. And if they don't feel heard again, then it tends to escalate. And we've all been in that example where we're trying to talk to someone and our kid does that and they get louder and more insistent and that kind of thing. So trying to respond really early to your kid can be really helpful. So for example, in that moment saying, look, I just really need to talk to this, my friend, for a minute, just hold my hand while we wait, or something like that, can be a really good way to try and respond early before it does get bigger and louder. Sometimes kids go straight to that 10 out of 10. Sometimes that listening will work. Sometimes it won't, and they'll escalate anyway. But yeah, responding early to let them know that you've heard them and you understand what they need can be really helpful to keep the behavior at that small level.
I agree. I had a tricky situation the other day where I was holding it together, barely, but they were right on the edge and I was trying to simmer it down and I was desperate to do a wee. And I'm the quickest weeer of all time, right? I just got to do a wee so quick. And I went inside. I would have been there for, I don't know, probably a minute. I was so quick. When I came back out, one of my kids had opened up the pool gate and thrown a chair into the pool in under a minute. Anyway, my hubby comes out of the office and he looks at me because I'm air quoting, I'm apparently the expert, and I'm not the expert in parenting at all. I absolutely do not touch the parenting space, but he's looking at me like, what do we do? And I looked at him like, I have no idea.
Yeah.
And he'd obviously been simmering around. I've been trying to put it out, but I think he was just going to escalate regardless. Sometimes I just feel like a freight train going down to a meltdown and it feels like there's nothing I can do. I try a lot of those strategies. Sometimes he's just going for it anyway. It's like a Friday afternoon. Mm-hmm. He's throwing in the pool chair. Is there anything that you can do? Like they're hitting each other. There's furniture being thrown. Like where do you go at that point? Because that's where I think kids get labeled as air quoting bad behaved. Because you see a behavior like that as someone who maybe has neurotypical children or doesn't have kids, and they're like, that's a badly behaved kid. But as a parent in that moment, you're like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, that's the bit where it's really difficult because there's not always a one size fits all thing. And it depends a lot on what is causing the behavior or what's underlying it. And so in that moment, there's probably a bit of impulsivity at play. But also if it was Friday afternoon, there's tiredness and the energy is run down. If it was an emotional dysregulation kind of thing, like they'd been fighting and it was managing that, it means the strategies are going to be slightly different depending on what the underlying reason was. So you can still do the same thing, like active listening is a big strategy, and that's really just trying to reflect back what's happening for your child. So, oh, hang on, you're really angry. I can see you're angry, or something like that. To just try and validate the emotions, which brings a bit of calmness to the situation. I say a bit, it's like it's a little bit. But even if it's a little bit and it lets you then be able to reason or problem solve, that's a good start. It's certainly hard when you've got more than one and they're all interacting with each other. But trying to reflect back the emotion and have your child feel heard is a good start. And then that's where I would use one of those, a reactive strategy, which is doing something a bit unexpected or something that will break whatever that behavior was. So for example, if you knew that, if maybe I'll ask you the question, is there anything that you know of in that moment that would completely stop your child doing that? If it was offering screen time or anything else, is there something you would have in your pocket to use then?
I probably wouldn't bribe, because then I feel like he's just thrown a chair in the pool and I'm offering him screen time. I'm like, the other two are going to be like, what? He just threw a pool chair in the pool and now he gets a screen? Like, I can only imagine what kind of feedback I'd get from them, because I'd think that's not probably going to go down well with the other two who haven't thrown a chair into the pool. I think after he threw the pool chair in, he ran down to the dam and attempted to get in there. Yes, and then he tried to go through a barbed wire fence. He seemed pretty off air. I think if I had have probably said to him, you can have your iPad for the rest of your life, I don't know if that would have stopped him. I don't even know if he would have heard, to be honest.
Yeah, yes.
Tricky one.
So there's a couple of good points in there, though, and I think that worry about rewarding your child by giving them what might stop the behavior is such a common one too, and that's really... it doesn't fit with how we understand parenting typically. But if you've got that 90% of stuff trying to teach the skills to be able to manage emotions and attention, that includes support to the environment so that kids can manage what's easier for them to go through their day to day. And you're teaching them about how to do everything you want them to do. And that's 90% of your effort in parenting. What you do in that 10% of time when things are kicking off is much less powerful. And so, for example, if you've got things in there, like once you've done all your jobs, you get some screen time. And if you are nice to your siblings, then you get some other reward and all of this other stuff. Then using the screen time because of the pool chair doesn't reinforce it as much, if that makes sense. You've still got the sibling issues of them looking at it, like, what are you doing? But I might have given them double the screen time than the other child got. There does also reach a point, which you've explained too, when kids have their behaviours escalated to the point where they're just not aware of what's going on and what's happening. And that's at that moment just about trying to keep your kids safe. So you don't really care about the pool chair or anything else, and get the other two to go and sit down or maybe be with their dad. And then you're just following the other one to make sure he's got somebody there to keep him safe in that moment of running around and going through fences and that kind of thing. There's not much you can do at that point. And maybe that's not a good thing to hear, like, oh, there's no good strategy. But sometimes it's good to hear in that, no, there's nothing else I could have done differently. We'd just reached the point where we need to sit it out with him. because eventually with time, like the body can't sustain being that agitated for long periods of time. So eventually the system will calm and he will calm. It's just about ensuring safety while that process takes its place.
You've made a really great point there, because it was really life-changing for me when someone said to me, sometimes your child is just going to melt down. There's nothing, like if you can go back in time at night and feel guilty and bad because you didn't do that then and you had to do a wee and you should have held it for longer, whatever it was that you think you could have done differently, they were probably going to do it anyway. Mm. And that made me feel better. So I think your point around it, sometimes when they've reached that 100, it doesn't matter what you say or do. It probably would have gone the way it was going to go anyway.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, once you're at that point, there's nothing new you can do. But you're right that you may not have been able to prevent it going to that point either. It's just, we don't need that layer of judgment on ourselves as parents. We can't fully control what our kids do.
One thing that I find confusing with the parenting space, and again, I'm not in the parenting space, that's an area that I'm still learning a lot in with a lot of the parenting advice that we see and read. For me, it's confusing when people talk about boundaries, because some people talk about setting a boundary and holding a boundary and removing a child from an environment. And other times people don't believe that's the case. And it's confusing. I was wondering what your point of view was around putting a boundary in place, because it's such an area of contention for parents, where you have particularly one parent that wants to do that, one that doesn't, and there can be that mismatch because there's so much information.
There is. I think it's really important that you get on the same page as parents, and that also is harder to do than it is to say. My view is that I think all kids need boundaries, because when we talk about boundaries, it's about letting kids know what is acceptable and what's not acceptable. But maybe it's good to think about it in terms of values as well, rather than particular behaviours. So there's no real right or wrong as to what you want the boundaries or values to be in your family. But I do think that consistently trying to make those things visible to our kids and holding them accountable to it is important, because it's what helps them understand what's expected of them, lets them also be able to explore and develop who they are as a person, but within those guidelines of what's okay and what's not okay. The caveat is, I think that you might have to have different boundaries for different kids. And that also is trouble for siblings to see. Or maybe it's just that you might need to be flexible if you find a boundary is not working for one of your kids, that then you change it for the whole family. I think that relates to how often, maybe it's problem solving too, because it's problem solving from the consequence of what happens. So an example might be saying that you get 10 minutes of screen time and then it finishes. Your typical kid might go, oh, okay, and put it down. Your kid with D might say, well, did you really mean that? I'll see how far I can push it to see. I feel like it's almost like they need more repetition of that boundary in order to be able to learn that it's a solid line they can't cross. When I see my kid not following the boundary and I know I don't have the energy to deal with it, I will pretend I didn't see it. Because I think once I've seen it, I've got to be consistent in holding the line. So if I say something, I absolutely have to follow through. But if they don't know I know and I can pretend I didn't, then I don't have to deal with it. There'll always be times when kids don't do what they're meant to if they think no one's watching, and I'll just let that one slide. But I think it's what they really learn is if we say something and we don't follow through, then our word doesn't carry any weight. And that becomes a really tricky place to be, because then you don't have respect from your child as to they don't believe that what you say is how it has to be.
Yeah, that's a really great point, actually. My hubby and I have a bit of a laugh about this, because I suppose that everyone has a different cleanliness rule in their house, but we try to get our boys to shower once a day. We try. And they don't like doing it. It's very difficult to get them in. So we're probably on it every 2 days, depending on if they've done soccer and stuff. We're a little bit more harder on it. But if they don't seem particularly dirty, sometimes I just can't do it. And so sometimes, because they hate showering, they'll go and change their undies, or they'll take their clothes off and then try and fly under the radar that like they showered. And I was making dinner the other day and my hubby came up to me and he said to me, I think the boys have changed their undies. I don't think they've showered. And he goes, oh, and he looked at me like, Are you going to do something about that? And I looked at him and I said to him, I don't have the ability to force them to shower today because I am absolutely not being a part of that. If you create chaos in that, you're on your own, buddy. You're on your own. And as soon as I said that, he just goes, I think we'll just let him go. And I was like, yep. Yes, we can. Because I understand your point, because it's like if you're going to make a half attempt and say, I know you've just changed your undies, it's shower time, but you know that if they kick off, you're not going to follow through. I personally, I just walk away. I'm like, that's a battle I can't do today.
Exactly. Just pretend you don't see it, I think. And this is where maybe it's about the values more than a strict boundary. So a boundary might be you have to shower once a day. And the value is it's important to our family that we look after ourselves and have good hygiene. That's really different to expecting a shower once a day. It gives room for people to make their own decisions about it. Is it once a day? Is it twice a day? Is it every second day? There's a little bit more flexibility there.
So I think it's a really good point, because if you attempt to parent perfectly, particularly if you have fluctuating capacity yourself, like I don't have the willpower to fight every battle with my child if they're not doing exactly what I want them to do every time. I just don't have the capacity. And so for me, I just think it's better, and I've made that choice myself, to pick my battle and follow through when I've picked it rather than try and parent perfectly, because I just know that some days I can't do it. If I have PMS and the boys don't want to shower, I'm like, look, I can't do that today, because I think it's better for them to just change their undies, fly under the radar, than for me to end up yelling at them, because I just think, well, what's worse?
I totally agree. And I think that really shows what I was trying to explain before about looking at it in terms of the long-term view. And what you're doing in that situation is firstly trying to keep the relationship good, because it's better to be talking nicely than yelling with our kids. It's better for them to be happy than to be angry at us. And knowing that this is a thing that will come with time as well. And you don't have to be perfect in your parenting every day to be able to guide your kids towards where you want them to go.
I think that's a really great point. As we finish up, is there anything that you wanted to mention as a point or anything I didn't ask that you'd like to share before we finish up?
I'll just have a look, because I did make some notes there about it. I think we've talked about most things in terms of, I guess, the behaviour being just what we see on the surface. And so where it might look like bad behaviour, I'm doing that air quotes thing as well, it's often just communicating something underlying. There's always a reason, and it's communicating a need, or it's representing a skill that your child doesn't have. And so we talked about how to respond to it as well. Probably the last thing I wanted to mention that we haven't is that sometimes your kids will be willfully difficult as well, but that's part of development. So you don't have to worry too much that you failed or they're not a good person, because it's the job of kids is to push the boundaries and to be difficult sometimes and be what we might traditionally say is naughty. It's their job sometimes to do that. And as they develop, they'll learn problem solving through that. They learn through making mistakes. And sometimes there will be that. And that's normal as well and doesn't reflect on you as a parent.
I think that's a really great point. So much value there, Leanne, and such a tricky topic. I find parenting as a topic generally particularly tricky. And when we go into some of those behaviours that come across as bad, we receive feedback and judgment from others that we need to be harder, harsher, have better discipline and have bigger punishments for those children. A lot of us are under those kind of people talk to us about that. And I think it's a very tricky area. Thank you so much for your time on it. It's an area that not many people are willing to come on as a guest and explore, because it is so tricky. And it's also very individualised. If you'd like to work with Leanne, do you do any one-on-ones, Leanne, if people want to work with someone individually?
Yeah, I do. So I'm based in Brisbane and see children in my clinic there, but I also work with parents online one-on-one. But I've also got some programs that parents can do as well, because I was, funnily enough, watching you talk on Instagram this morning about how it's so hard to access private providers for things like psychology and that kind of thing. And I completely agree. So trying to provide an option that provides parents with the support they need to help their kids, but in a way that's easier to access than seeing a psych in person, and also a bit more affordable as well. And so all the details are on my website.
Oh, thank you so much. We will put the website into the show notes, of course. And if you'd like to check out Leanne on Instagram, I'm going to pop in all of her social media as well and her programs. Thank you so much for your time, Leanne. I really appreciate it.
You're so welcome. It was so exciting to be able to talk with you today.
Oh, thank you so much. It is a really tricky topic. So I was glad that someone was actually able and willing to put their hand up for it.
Hopefully I've done it justice.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD month shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.